the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people will turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. For all thy again and get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream at that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live audio stream there. We're streaming live audio at abibitumi.com. That's abibitumi.com. They stream from Ghana, or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, it's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream or the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So, again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:06 here on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, the Sunday, May 5th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, several guests with us, dealing with an important topic that we may or may not know too much about. Richard Brookshire, CEO and co-founder of the Black Veterans Project. Mr. Raelynn Brooks, law intern at the Veterans Legal Clinic at Yale Law School, and our special guest joining us that brought the suit, Mr. Conley Brooks Jr. The suit, the historic suit about Black veterans reparations lawsuit, will be in the topic of our discussion this evening. You can join the conversation always by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832 is the call-in number. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back. It's Time for an Awakening. It's 7:12 here on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. One day, probably in the next life, I'm going to be a weather forecaster because I don't know what's going on, Elliot, with this head. One time it's 90 and then the next time it's 50 and raining. I mean, like, what they think a brother's supposed to do? I don't understand it. But I am looking forward to this conversation, and it's interesting, you know, because of which I don't talk about much, you know, my personal experience in dealing with you know, the whole thing of being a short-term veteran for a period, but then having the recognizing from a historical perspective, Black men and women who have fought and for everybody celebrate from the beginning of this republic till now, and have been not honored in the same way. So this here case is really and how we came to it. I'm really interested in to see what it means for us who did go through this process.
Richard, you know, when you pulled my coat to this particular story a couple of weeks ago, I was totally unaware of it, to be honest. And I'm going to be honest, it's kind of caught me off guard. But it kind of falls in line of a lot of the subjects that we deal with on this program. The struggle for our people to get justice in this country is a continuous struggle, and it seems like it'll be endless. But we need people on the front lines of these battles. That's what we continuously talk about on the program. The three men that I'm going to speak to tonight are dealing with this issue. In 2022, a federal lawsuit was filed against the U.S. government for discrimination against countless Black military veterans dating back decades, rejecting service-connected disability claims disproportionately compared to their white counterparts, blocking access to housing, education benefits that help fuel the rise of America's middle class. This evening, our guests are going to share with us information on this important issue. Mr. Richard Brookshire, CEO and co-founder of the Black Veterans Project. Mr. Raylan Brooks, law intern at the Veterans Legal Clinic at Yale Law School. And Mr. Connolly Brooks, Connolly Monk Jr. is joining us also in this conversation. I'm going to bring all the men involved on with us tonight. Mr. Brookshire, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. I think Mr. Raylan is here. Mr. Raylan?
Hi, I'm here. Nice to be here.
Great, great. And Mr. Monk is joining us. Mr. Monk, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here, but I'm Gary Monk. I'm not Conley Monk.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And it's okay.
All right.
So, yeah.
Was Conley Monk your dad?
Conley Monk is actually my brother.
Okay.
And then my dad is also in on this lawsuit, too. He fought in Normandy.
Good.
So, yes.
You know,
Conley Monk Jr. is my brother.
Good. Okay. Mr. Monk, we want everybody to partake in this conversation because it's important, and all of you men are kind of dealing with different aspects of this particular case. But I don't know where to start as far as I know it'll probably be with Mr. Brookshire or Mr. Monk to talk about the origin of this case and how it was brought. Can you kind of fill our listening audience in on the Black Veterans lawsuit? Yes, go ahead.
Gary, do you want me to start or you want to start?
Yes, I do. I want you to set it up.
You want me to start it off? Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I think, one, it's important to know that Black folk have been serving our country since its inception and have often found it challenging to gain equitable access to veterans' benefits. You can look back to the Civil War and fights over pensions, and, this isn't a new conversation. It's been happening since the very inception of our service. But I like to start the conversation and ground it in and around World War II, because it was an opportunity that the country had with the advent of the GI Bill, which was a series of social welfare programs that were built, to service, the several million men and women who had gone off and served overseas to ensure that they had pathways to economic opportunity at home. You had an opportunity to be able to go to school for the first time en masse for working class folks through GI Bill education benefits. You also had access to VA back home loans, right? So, but the vast majority of folks before the 1940s didn't necessarily own their homes in the same measure. And it really transformed the American middle class, this kind of new social welfare program. Of the million black vets that returned after World War II, about less than 5% got access to VA home loans, and very nominal numbers of folks were able to take advantage of education benefits, in part because, you know, there was legalized segregation at the time. They weren't allowed to go to white institutions. And the ecosystem of HBCUs in the South weren't able to absorb the million returning black GIs, right? And because of that, you had an economic chasm that, you know, the country has never quite fully recovered from, and very much informed the economic inequality that we see today. There was a recent Brandeis study about 2 years ago that looked at just the economic impact of the denial of VA home loans because of redlining, because of racial covenants, because of discriminatory practices in banking. And they did a study of, okay, what would that cost? What did that cost every returning black GI between 1945 and 1956, the original window of the policy? And you know, I can give some statistics. You have about 3,000 loans that were given out, I believe, in 1948, according to an Ebony magazine study in the state of Mississippi. Less than 3 of those loans went to black folks, right? And so there were thousands of returning black GIs in Mississippi that should have been able to receive that benefit. But Brandeis did this study, and they found that, you know, on average, a black veteran and their family lost out on $80,000 in wealth accumulation that they would have otherwise had access to had they been able to fully utilize their GI Bill in the same vein as their white counterparts. Aggregate, you know, you aggregate that, you're looking at $70 to $80 billion in lost economic wealth for the black community just in a 10-year window of inaccessibility to VA home loans. And so that's where kind of our project gets born. But then also, I think it starts, you know, become really important to understand Conley's story and how it intersects. Our project has, you know, our Black Veterans Project has been wanting to tie the historical legacy of benefit obstruction to the present day, and kind of look at a lot of these different service areas as pieces of the puzzle, right? Because our country has a pretty insidious way of hearkening racism and cementing racism into its institutions. And so much of our project has been wanting to parse out not only just the data, but the stories from the different kind of eras of service and piece them together and then formulate a case for reparations, of which the Conley-Monk case is but one of several approaches that we'll be taking. Conley's story is so important, and I want to make sure that I give Gary an opportunity to maybe come in on this part, talk about the Vietnam era a little bit and a little bit of background about Conley's journey, and then we'll kind of bring us back to the present day after that, and I'll tell you how this legal case got situated.
Thank you, Richard. I really appreciate it. And most of all, we want to thank our host, Mr. Booker and Mr. Richard, for having this medium that is for the culture. I really acknowledge you guys for this program. Fantastic. So here it is. My brother was a Vietnam veteran, and is a Vietnam veteran, Conley Monk Jr. So he did two tours. Conley experienced a lot of racism while in Vietnam. When he got back to America, there was wasn't the word called PTSD yet. So he couldn't even get benefits because he was given administrative discharge, fat papers, we call it. And so here's this guy, has a family, couldn't even get his job back at the VA. Fast forward 45 years, my brother's been fighting to get benefits for veterans with less than honorable discharges. And inside of that, he needed medical service because he was self-medicating. He needed employment, which he couldn't secure, a good wage. He had to work a few jobs to make a decent living. He couldn't approach the educational system because they wouldn't support him in terms of giving him his benefits, his educational benefits. So here we are. No medical benefits, no educational benefits. And again, couldn't even get his old job back. So this young man, he continued to fight for not just himself. It wasn't about him, you always said. As a matter of fact, he built a monument here in New Haven in 84, a Vietnam Veterans monument on Long Wharf in New Haven, Connecticut, Black Ivory, and the relevance of that is him not thinking of himself, thinking of others, He honored the other vets. He honored all the Vietnam veterans. Back to the point is that he became a PTSD kid. What I mean by that, and he sued the government, I think it was Magus versus Monk. U.S. Former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel created a memo that stated any veterans that have been determined to have PTSD or TBI or any related diseases be given liberal consideration to have their discharges upgraded. And then inside of that, he won that lawsuit. It was five plaintiffs. He was the lead plaintiff. And then winning that lawsuit, he has discharged, upgraded. This is 45 years later. He's been fighting all this time, all his life. And that really set the veteran, or shall I say, the melanated veteran up powerfully. Because if you look at statistics, most of the bad papers are given to the melanated veteran. And he continued to fight, but he wasn't satisfied with the compensation. And we continued to talk with Yale Law School and Richard at the Black Veterans Organization, and came about with doing some due diligence and getting some real information on what the VA did and didn't do to the melanated veteran. So here we are with the lawsuit now, and my dad was deported in Normandy, County Junior, fought in Vietnam, as I stated. And as Richard stated earlier, well, you can go back to the beginning of the existence of this, like Brother said, Republic, that we've been on the front line fighting without getting due compensation. And so what's so sad about that is that it's not just due compensation. We didn't have a halfway level field so we could benefit from being that soldier. So here we are now. We continue to fight, and now we're suing to ensure that the trajectory of how the VA treats the veteran, the melanated veteran, is changed in a way that a system built that have some sort of equality. I mean, right now it has zero. Some sort of equality so these veterans can be taken care of properly, so they can get the medical care, they can get the educational care, et cetera. So Richard, I'll bounce it back to you if Mr. Brooks don't want to step in on this.
I'll start up for Mr. Brooks. So we, in 2020, started a partnership with Yale Law School and the Black Veterans Project, wanting to look at data going back about 2020. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Before we kind of speed up, I want to kind of go a little bit slower. Let me go back, and because I got a couple questions for you, but let me go back to Mr. Monk. Mr. Monk, you mentioned that your brother Connolly, fought in Vietnam. Were you also in Vietnam, or you was in another one of the wars or conflicts?
I was in a total another era, but I had another brother that was in Vietnam era, but he was stateside, and had a sister who was in Vietnam era, but she was stateside as well.
And
as I stated, my father was in World War II, Normandy Division.
Do me a favor if you can, Mr. Monk, because it sounds like you might be on a hands free.
I'm actually on an iPad, but let me see if I can. You want to me get closer? Maybe?
Yeah, it would be better. Yeah, that way we wouldn't have much feedback.
Okay, can you hear me any better?
Yes.
Okay.
And said that your dad fought in World War II.
Yes, he fought in the invasion of Normandy.
Okay,
in World War II.
Now, this lawsuit. Just like you said, it shows the injustices of what has happened to Black veterans. Your dad, did he have any type of disability, or you might not have noticed it because you was a young man, but did you notice any changes to him when he came back from the service, beside the discrimination that all Blacks was going through at that period? But did he have any types of problems, maladies, or anything that was developed from being in the service?
I'm glad that you asked that question. They called it something different at that time, but it was PTSD, war fatigue, or what have you. My father worked two jobs, 16 hours a day for 25 years, because he couldn't tap into the benefits for the veterans. So he had severe PTSD. And the way he took care of himself was working. He worked himself to death, literally. He had a stroke and had Parkinson's, acquired Parkinson. So, yes, absolutely. My father had severe PTSD.
And you said that he was in Normandy.
Yes, he fought in the invasion of Normandy.
Yeah, well, you know what? I've never been in the service. And the closest thing I can relate to that is that the movie that they made, Ryan, Private Ryan. But if anything, like, yes, that type of horror will give anybody PTSD and all types of problems, seeing that type, correct, of carnage. But I just wanted to kind of get an idea of, you know, the service-connected injuries that your family suffered, because it seems like several members of your family fought in different conflicts. So, Richard... before I, well, let me ask Mr. Brooks this, and then I'm going to flip it over to you, Richard. Mm-hmm. Mr. Brooks, Mr. Brookshire, I'm sorry. You talked about the evidence of clear discrimination against the black veterans coming home in housing, having access to medical education. And you cited, and you used that as an example, Mississippi veterans when they came home. I forgot what year that you said, but 1,000 people received education benefits, and only 3 of them, of the returning veterans, were black. Did you
about 3,000 received home loans, and less than 3 were black?
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you see that over the years? Because this spans decades. Did you notice any type of the branches of the service being harder on black veterans, or they were basically across the board, the racial discrimination spanned the gamut? And when I say any of the branches, the Marine, because for a while there, you didn't have that many black Marines, but you had a lot, yeah, of them in the Army. So and the Air Force was totally different, as far as I know. So did you notice, mm-hmm, of any types of things dealing with the heavy discrimination in the certain branches of the armed forces?
I haven't looked into that. I mean, I have read books about the kind of Vietnam being the first fully integrated war, and so the hardships of the Army and integration as the largest kind of military force. But I imagine, you know, yeah, there were hardships across all the branches, specifically in the officer corps, and I think they still remain pretty diminutive presence of black folk at, you know, specialty training schools, at military academies, and so on and so forth. But I will say, I think there was a study done, if I'm wanting to look at more recent data, that shows that even current black service members are up to twice as likely to get kicked out of the military without an honorable discharge. And that's, you know, it's tied to a historical legacy that really started around World War II with blue paper discharges, right, where you could just get kicked out for pretty much any reason without any real due process. We saw that black vets were some of the, even though they served at the front lines, some of the highest rates, and certainly were dying as casualties of the war in Vietnam at very high rates. They were widely disproportionately getting dishonorable discharges. And there was never really a desire to reckon with that until, you know, a host of different vets have been working around that issue. But certainly Conley Monk's efforts have made a dent in that in a significant way. I would love to bring Brother Brooks into the conversation and maybe have him speak about the Yale work a little bit more, and like the evidence that we've gathered.
Good. Mr. Brooks, can you hear me?
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having us. This is a really important conversation, and I'm really grateful to Yale for providing us the space to have it.
And you know what, Mr. Brooks, I don't know whether you're on a hands-free. Are you on a hands-free?
I am. Let me, is that better?
If you can get on, you know, with your, because it causes feedback and we can't really understand it, almost like you're talking underwater.
Is that better?
Yes, yes. Excellent.
All right. Great. So thank you, Richard and Gary. So where Yale comes into this story is after the
You know, we worked with Richard on FOIA litigation, Freedom of Information Act litigation in 2021 that, you know, for decades we'd known about, we'd heard sort of anecdotal reports and widespread suspicions of disproportionate grants of benefits claims to Black veterans. And just to give you a sense of how big those grants can be, if you receive the highest disability rating from the VA, that means you get a $4,000 cash payment tax-free every month for the rest of your life. It is a huge figure that changes people's lives, and Black veterans have been systematically barred from collecting on what is rightfully theirs. So we'd known, sort of, it had been in the air. It'd been known for some time. And in fact, in 1972, the Defense Department and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission put out a report that said that military discharges were so tainted by race discrimination that if an employer only hired soldiers and veterans who had, if they required honorable discharges, it was tantamount to a violation of the Civil Rights Act because those discrimination, those discharge statuses were so tainted by racism. So as far back as 1972, for sure, there's documentation of this, but we know that it goes back as far as World War II. Yale comes into the picture in 2021 when, with the help of Richard Brookshire and his organization, we filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was basically meant to get the VA to cough up internal data that would help us put numbers to this. And in fact, they did have the numbers. Between 2001 and 2020, the data showed that Black veterans, both Black men and Black women, were systematically under-granted their benefits claims, specifically their disability claims, which is the largest of the programs that the VA administers. And so in light of this, what we realized was that, and what we'd known for sure but were able to put numbers to now, was that it wasn't just Mr. Monk. It was thousands of other Black veterans. And so we brought this lawsuit in 2022 as a way of addressing the fact that the VA knew or should have known that these racial disparities existed and that they were negligent in not correcting them.
And I'll interject and say, and go a step further and say that the evidence that we've been able to gather today shows that the VA did know that it had conducted a, as of right now, we have our hands on two reports, a 2009 report and a 2017 report, both of which were internally buried by VA, that speak to these grant rate disparities. And because they weren't acted on, a maintenance of about a 16% disparity carried all over the course of two decades. And when you look at that and kind of baked into those figures, those are tens of thousands of Black and Hispanic vets, right? And when you start to quantify, like get into the numerical value of what we're talking about, when the average grant rate you're supposed to get somewhere around $1,600 a month, you start to see that this is you're talking about tens of billions of dollars in missed disability payments to the poorest and most marginalized of some of these vets.
You know, Richard, I'm going to pass it to you, but I want to read from this published report in the Washington Post in 2022 to bolster what Mr. Brookshire just stated. I don't even know whether he's still the VA press secretary, but it says VA press secretary Terrence Hayes did not address the lawsuit, but said in a statement that the agency is working to combat institutional racism. Officials are reviewing policies to serve veterans who are wrongly received punitive discharges, which in most cases led to the VA to block their benefits. Throughout history, they have been unacceptably discharged in both VA benefits decisions, military discharge status due to racism, which has wrongly left Black veterans without access to VA care and benefits, Hayes says. We are actively working to right these wrongs Well, we've heard this story before, but Richard, jump in here.
He said, we've heard that story before. And then I wanted to make sure that we're helping to flush this out, you know, in this conversational thing, because a lot of points interest me. And Mr. Monk, you know, as you were explaining about your father and your brother in relationship to being veterans and the ill effects, I'm interested in in their circle of friends who were veterans, are you aware of any kind of discussion about those men having complaints or you know, going through the process in denial that relate? I mean, in the sense of that it isn't just about, you know, your immediate family, but out of that, were, do you have any personal experience about that, that those discussions, those observation as far as getting their, I think it's called ratings, they're getting their ratings. Mr. Monk, are you there?
Uh-oh. Am I? Mr. Monk?
Well, maybe he walked away. Okay. So let me ask.
What was the question? I'll try to respond to
Mr. Brookshire, is about the Black Veterans Project. When did it start and why?
Right. Okay. So the Black Veterans Project started at the end of 2018. I'm an Army vet. I was a former Army combat medic. And I had a pretty difficult transition out. On paper, I think it was pretty, you know, extraordinary. I graduated with an Ivy League graduate degree, got a great job with the city in New York. But, you know, the country was changing rapidly. I kind of finally put off the uniform for good after 7 years and just really struggled with my service. And I kept going to the VA to try to get help for, you know, the struggle of transition, and was, you know, continuously turned away. And, you know, my mental health just wasn't a priority to them. And unfortunately, you know, after about a year of really struggling, it led to a suicide attempt. And it was on the other side of that suicide attempt, very, very spiritual, in many respects, that I prayed, for guidance about, you know, how to use my skills, how to use, you know, my gifts to do, you know, great work. And I just so happened that when I was in the psych ward, the only thing that there was to do was read. And so folks kept dropping books that had been sitting on my shelves for a long time, but I'd never kind of cracked open. And there was one book called When Affirmative Action Was White by a Columbia University professor named Ira Katz Nelson. And in it, he has a couple of chapters that are dedicated to the GI Bill. So, you know, I had, you know, been familiar with, obviously, racially biased obstruction to VA home loans and all of that, but not like in depth. And I think it really made it really salient to me, that, and then having just experienced my own dilemmas by way of accessing, you know, equitable care at VA. And then after I got out of the hospital, I kind of spent a few weeks, you know, scouring Brooklyn. At that point, I had, you know, lost my job. And so I was going to some different events for unemployed vets, and it struck me that the vast majority of folks in these rooms were Black, many of which were formerly incarcerated, many of which had dishonorable discharges, many of which were homeless and facing all sort of social dilemma. And so I got with a friend, Kyle Bibby, who I'd gone to graduate school with, and he said, hey, you know, I think there's a research-based project that needs to start, research and advocacy-based project that needs to start here. I just don't quite know how to piece it together. And so for the course of about a year, we workshopped the project. I took a role to lead communications at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, so got my chops with respect to veterans advocacy there, and kind of getting a real lay of the land by the way in which, like, legislation actually gets done for vets. Kyle took a job at an organization called Common Defense, which works to organize progressive vets. And we built out, you know, a basic framework for Black Veterans Project. And at that point, we weren't quite sure exactly what the organization was going to be doing. We just knew that there was a need to get our hands on data. There was a need to connect the historical legacy that we could see being, you know, fractured. Our generation was very disconnected from the generations that came before us that, you know, would go and frequent the, you know, veterans of foreign wars or American legions and so on and so forth. Our generation was very much on the internet. And when you Googled Black vets back in 2018, not very much would come up other than a few academic articles and maybe a couple of like articles celebrating older Black vets or the Tuskegee Airmen, but certainly nothing talking about the history and legacy of benefit obstruction. And I knew that there was a burgeoning case for reparations and I wanted to be part of that. And so that was how the project was birthed and it's evolved. And it's really, I think, been catalyzed most by this partnership with Yale Law School. It's been an invaluable partnership. And we came to them with the idea of like, hey, we know that the VA has data, you know, in ways that it's never had before, and we want to get our hands on it. Because as we're reading reports, as we're reading, you know, existing academic papers, we see such large gaps in what should be readily available to tell a more cognizant history of the inequities that we see so clearly on the ground. And so much of this work has been trying to connect those dots.
Richard, before you go back to Mr. Monk, because he's back on with us. Can I just jump in and ask a question? Mr. Brookshire, listen, I want to, because we usually do this, and I usually have a habit of doing this with people that have been on with us in various different activism that they have indulged in or active in. Talk to me, Mr. Richard, Mr. Brookshire. When you came back and you said that you had suffered, and I think that I read that you were in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. When you came back and you said you, you know, you were really going through it, suicide attempt, things of that nature. And then when you started to kind of get yourself together, you ventured into areas where you could try to get help on employment and things of that nature. And you seen other Black veterans and you knew something is wrong with this picture. So when you started, because I know that you had to do this in the beginning, when you started talking to other men about, man, something is wrong here and we need to do something, I know that you got responses like, well, you know, we can't do nothing. What can we do? You can't make a difference. What made you?
Yeah.
What? Wait a minute. What made
I think I understand the question. You're like, what gave me the audacity?
Yeah, no. But this is what I'm saying. What made you keep saying, no, I can do something about this. We have to do something about this, and I'm going to be a part of it. What separated you from a lot of the naysayers and procrastinators? Because that's what's needed.
I thank God. I mean, I'm not going to say they don't. I believe I'm called to do this work, and in a deeply spiritual way. And I think that life has aligned me to do this work. My skills have aligned me to do this work. And I think there has been a lot of tribulations in doing this work. Not only just naysayers, but not everybody is your friend when you're trying to make real progressive change. You know, there are a lot of folks that like the status quo the way that it is. And I'll leave that at that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly been difficult, but I come back to like, I don't know, just like a deep sense of responsibility to the community. That's one. And then two, I'm just audacious as hell. And I like making good trouble. And I like to work with co-conspirators that want to help make good trouble. And so I don't know. I just have a deep, deep, unfettered belief that this country can be better than what it is and what it has been. And I try to hold faith to that. I think what I've had to learn, though, is when to take a break, when to step back, when to let things flow. Legal cases take a long time. Legislative advocacy takes a long time. You know, how do you build public narratives? It's a very complicated process when we have such a, saturated media landscape. How do you really organize in effective ways? How do you build out a case for reparations for Black vets when the system is so complicated too? The Monk case is obviously very expansive, but there are multitudes of different ideas that we have about reparative justice, right? When you think about the main driver of dishonorable discharges for Black folk in the military, even to this day, has been marijuana, right? We have a changing legal landscape around marijuana in this country. How do we make sure that there are reparative measures for the men that have been unjustly denied access to their benefits for, you know, decades, right? If not more. When you look at the legacy of VA home loans, there's the Senator Warnock and Congressman Clyburn bill, the GI Bill Restoration Act, that seeks to give descendants of Black World War II veterans access to VA home loans and education benefits, right? Like, how do you then, like, really bring organizing power to bear to get a piece of legislation like that passed, right? How do you, how are you able to permeate the public imagination in a way where they get it, they understand the necessity of it? Not easy work, but I just find it thrilling. I find it deeply exciting. And I think at my core, I'm a storyteller and a movement builder. And this work feeds the soul as much as I give to it, it also feeds me. So yeah, I hope that answers your question. Not an easy,
yes.
easy question.
Yes. Richard, go ahead, because I know you want to talk.
Let me say this. I came out in 72, and based off of even just hearing this conversation, I could have been one with the classification, the discharge classification that you're speaking to. But at the time I came out, I think it was 8 of us. I'm probably the only one that didn't come out with a general or dishonorable. Right. So I'm very much aware of the impact at that point in life. When you said Mr. Brookshire being a storyteller, and that's what I wanted to get from you, Mr. Monk, in your family discussion, because we have a World War II, we have a Vietnam veteran. And then we're living through, you know, these wars that we've been, or conflicts that we've been dealing with. Did you hear any stories across veterans that you communicate with us that spoke to not necessarily their service experience, but the difficulty in relationship to dealing with the Department of Veterans Affairs?
Absolutely. You know, you got to get that. I co-founded this organization with my brother. I'm 10 years his junior. However, I was right at his side when he came back from Nam. I seen what he was going through physically and mentally, you know. And my dad, I seen him deteriorate. I seen his demise. My history, our history. With the military, go back, Civil War. We can put our fingers on it, right? But to answer your question, we created this organization as a result of what happened to the veterans that put in for benefits and couldn't get them. And you got to remember that the veteran service organizations, back then, you couldn't come through the door unless you had an honorable discharge.
Right.
So, of course, my brother was denied, but many others were denied. And so I seen this, and we were meeting. As a matter of fact, we had created an organization called the Undesirables. I just want to say that again so you can get the memo. We called ourselves the Undesirables because we had bad papers and nobody wanted to deal with us at all. So I'm saying the organizations that was veterans organizations that were set up to support the veteran would not listen to us. We couldn't get a toe in that door. So, yes, I seen many veterans and heard and sat and talked with these veterans that was experiencing the same things as my brother was in terms of benefits. And again, these guys, a lot of them that came from Nam, everybody was using heroin. And so when they came back, they had a habit in addition to not being able to assimilate back into society in a way that they should have been. Now, fast forward to the methadone program. I would say, and my brother was a senior counselor, became a senior counselor eventually, that the guys there was the methadone program was probably 90% veterans, Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And so these young men could not get services. And so we started hitting the pavement, trying to get anything we can get for these veterans to get them in the VA to get help, medical help. And the same thing with employment. So we did a lot of networking. But yes, that's where we began.
And if I have an opportunity to come back around, I like to get is there a memorable story, you know, beyond your own immediate family that you, you know, can communicate. And I think it's important for the Time for Waking audience to hear, as you said, because we get these generalizations of homeless, you know, veterans that are homeless, veterans on service, but the, you know, to put the humanity and the mixed match of these service agencies or departments as it relates to black veterans particularly. But Mr. Brooks, and I understand you're at Yale, you know, this program that you're working through as an intern at Yale collecting this data. And I'm curious about this data collection. And you mentioned about the Freedom of Information Act. Okay. How difficult now that even in, you know, and Elliot read an article and y'all spoke to it, how difficult it is to get this data, this process for this case? What is the not just the steps, but what is the experience you've had, or if you're working with a team, in order to, because I just don't see the Department of Veteran Affairs saying, here, come and get it, right? So what is that challenge that you had to walk through and landmines you had to realize were there in order to get this data for this particular case?
That's a really good question. So I also want to say that the data piece of this is the meat and potatoes. That's what we're that's really like what's driving our initiated the litigation and is what we are the most involved in doing right now. So just to like lay a little bit of background. So because our case was allowed to continue this past March, it's the judge who is overseeing the case denied the government's motion to dismiss it. What that means is we've now moved we restarted the discovery process. So that means we now have the court's approval to get officials at the VA into a room and ask them questions about what they knew and didn't know, and in terms of what they did know, what data they have to show it. In terms of before discovery, my team, we had to sue to get it, if that makes it any – they're not – the way that it typically works is that you can submit a Freedom of Information Act request, but – there are lots of ways to get around a Freedom of Information Act request. Mm. And the VA initially produced, you know, a little bit here. They produced a little bit over here. Sometimes it took going back to them multiple times. Sometimes they didn't give us what we wanted. There are lots of ways to get around disclosing that information. But now that we are in this discovery phase, we're hoping that it'll be a lot harder for them to say, no, we don't have it, or no, we're not going to give it to you. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And before I go back to Mr. Brookshire's, before, you know, I turn it back over to Elliot. So what is there within the Department of Veterans Affairs, the data points, the data information that you're looking for, is there specific departments that you have to request in order to support this case? Because I take it the Department of Veterans Affairs is a bureaucracy, and in that bureaucracy has a lot of departments, and you know, right. you have to be conscious of
the vast majority of the information that we're seeking comes out of the Veterans Benefits Administration, so the office that oversees the allocation of benefits. Okay. Specifically. And I will say kind of another point outside of just FOIA, there also have been good deed public servants, or AKA whistleblowers, who have come forward at different points in this work to provide insight, to recommend, items to FOIA. We wouldn't have known about the 2017 study if it wasn't for a whistleblower bringing that to light. We maybe would have dragged for, you know, a few more years of litigation to unearth it, right? I think that we can't underestimate the value of those public servants and good faith actors who, you know, are willing to kind of stick their neck out and provide some level of assistance.
And you know, and the thought just passed me as you were saying that, in relationship to, you know, the whistleblower itself. Itself. So I guess I have to leave that alone. So Ellie, you rescue me. So I won't, but this is definitely, very, very important, to, you know, and I know from another perspective, how as important it is to, Black veterans. And I, you know, especially from that rating, but you're talking about even a step before not even being actually able to get the rating because of the type of discharge. Yeah, that's powerful.
Let me ask this before we, because we're coming up to the top of the hour, we're going to take a brief break. And then when we come back, I want to get some callers involved in the conversation. And you could do that by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Before we break, Mr. Brookshire, Mr. Monk, and Mr. Brooks, you might have something to say in reference to this, because it's thousands of children of Black veterans and veterans themselves that might not have fared like yourself, Mr. Brookshire. But when I say like yourself, you said that you attempted to take your life. Some have succeeded in doing that because of service connected situations where they have come back and couldn't adjust. And the reason I'm asking this, because I'm looking at that report that was in the Washington Post, and let me read it, Mr. Monk, because you can kind of help me with this. It says, Monk's father served in a segregated army unit during World War II and was denied VA disability payments for a stomach condition developed in the military, according to a separate administration claim filed by the clinic. Monk Jr., who oversees his father's estate, is seeking... Hold on a second, I'm sorry. Is seeking $1 million in damages for VA denial of his dad's medical care and disability pay, which have amounted to tens of thousands of dollars, according to the claim. So, in this lawsuit, Mr. Brookshire, Mr. Brooks, and Mr. Monk, is it room for children such as yourself, Mr. Monk, looking at your dad, to be able to file for benefits that were never received by the person involved that could have benefited the family? Is it help me through that, because I'm quite sure it's thousands of people in that situation.
Well, I have it that, for instance, that $1 million would be divvied up between my father's descendants. So my immediate siblings would get that. And if I do have a brother that deceased, God bless him, that his downline would get his. And so we're looking at, hopefully every veteran can put in something similar. And I want Mr. Brooks to clear me up on that. But that's how I see
sure.
it.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Brooks.
So the way that we're doing it right now is that it's kind of technical, but basically what we need to do first is identify all of the Black veterans who had their benefits denied and have tried to get the have exhausted all their other avenues at the VA. They're called FTCA claim exhaustions. It's kind of technical, but like basically the idea is that they have to go through this process where they file an administrative claim. And if after filing administrative claim, the VA still won't give them their benefits, then they should reach out to us and we can, they should, our hope is to find as many vets who have had this happen to them as possible.
Okay.
And gone through this process in the hopes that once we identify the scope of it, we can start thinking about the knock-on effects, the generational effects, how it reverberates across families. We're starting small, but we're thinking big here.
Okay. Right.
And I think that there are other potential avenues for litigation as well, outside of just even the Monk case itself, that, you know, is related specifically to families, maybe, you know, related to the private companies that the VA has, contracted through for examinations, which we know have been culpable in large part for the maintenance of these disparities. And so on and so forth. I think some of these other paths will reveal themselves in time as we continue to dig and find what we know has always been there, but just has been hidden from public view.
And I just want to underline what Brother Burchard just said. That's what the value of the discovery process is that we're now moving into is. We're just starting to get to the belly of the beast. And once we see it, we can start thinking more about what else we can do.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the discussion. Like I said, there's a couple of callers online. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in discussion with Mr. Richard Brookshire, CEO and co-founder of the Black Veterans Project, Mr. Rillian Brooks, law intern at the Veterans Legal Clinic at Yale Law School, and also our special guest, Mr. Gary Monk. Is involved. The lawsuit is basically centers around the experiences of the Monk family and other Black veterans that have suffered discrimination by the United States government. Again, you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commits You Black family. To join your interconnected Commits You Black communities, escape the digital plantation now. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
A new era, a new phase of the struggle. where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we are getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationists, people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea what they want the Negro to be in America?
I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
And know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community, to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda.
Whites are expert game players in their contests to maintain absolute power. One of their time-honored gimmicks is to point to individual blacks who've achieved recognition. But look at Ralph Bunche. Think about Lena Horne or Marian Anderson. Look at Jackie Robinson. They made it as one of those who has made it. I would like to be thought of as an inspiration to our young. But I don't want them lied to. Name them for me. The examples of blacks who made it. For virtually everyone you name, I can give you a sordid piece of factual information on how they have been mistreated, humiliated. Not being able to fight back is a form of severe punishment.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
For an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:11 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, Mr. Richard Brookshire, CEO and co-founder of the Black Veterans Project, Mr. Rillian Brooks, law intern at the Veterans Legal Clinic at Yale Law School, and also Mr. Gary Monk is with us this evening, one of the founders and a driving force behind the Black Veterans Project. You can join the conversation with a question or comment by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Excuse me. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Atlanta. Atlanta, you there? Can you hear me? Uh-oh, let's go up here. Atlanta, are you there?
No. Okay, Brother Richard, I mean, Brother Elliot?
Yes.
Yes, sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
Well, greetings, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard and your guests. I'm quite familiar with the case because I'm dealing with discrimination here in Georgia as well. And actually, that lawsuit was filed on my grandma's birthday. But I like very much like to be a part of the Black Veterans Project. I've been trying to reach somebody in regards to this. So before the show ends, if I can, if your guests can leave some contact information so I can be a part of what's going on and hopefully help facilitate some kind of resolution to it. So that's my comment, and I continue to listen to the radio program.
Well, hold on before you go, brother. Help us with this a little bit, because you said that you were trying to get involved with the Black Veterans Project, and just so happens we got all three of the men, the driving forces here this evening. But talk about your experiences. You heard Mr. Monk talk about his experiences in the service. His dad fought in World War II, was in the invasion of Normandy, and the problems that he had when he came back. Mr. Brookshire talked about the problems that he had when he was in Afghanistan as a medic and came back to the point where, you know, he was ready to take his own life. Talk about it from your perspective as a Black veteran, and you're in the South. When you got back from the service, whatever branch you were involved in, and you tried to access benefits, talk about your experiences. And because you said that you were trying to get involved in the organization, so lets me know that you was going through the same brick wall that they were facing. But talk about it from your experiences. Just share with us.
Well, I mean, I was in the Marine Corps. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps, and I was actually down in Camp Lejeune, and I was exposed to that contaminated water. But my whole experience in the Marine Corps was nothing but discrimination, and that discrimination continues. And I think even now, I filed on numerous occasions for benefits and stuff like that, and of course I was denied. And trying to access the VA and its web of, it's just a maze of trying to find the answer to something you never find. It's just never reciprocal, and I always get the feeling of being discriminated when I would file for benefits and stuff like that. I just never received. I was always getting denial letters. But, and I just, me personally, I just know that that's what it's been, is to read. I did a little research, and I ran across Brother Monk's case. I actually have been following it. I've been trying to reach out to the Yale, the college there. They have that school there for law interns who help bring the suit. I just haven't been successful in reaching anybody. So I just want to do my part and try to help facilitate to bring some of this stuff to some kind of resolution, to bring it to light that we as veterans are being discriminated in this country. So I was just glad you was able to contact these guys and have them on the program today.
Mr. Brookshire, Mr. Brooks, or even Mr. Monk, anything to say to our caller?
Yeah, I'll start. Yeah. When I want to say thank you for your service. I'll say second, you know, Black Veterans Project has been a labor of love, a very grassroots effort with no real full-time staff. We're hoping to change that, but for the last 5 years, we've been small and mighty, but emphasis on the small. And even in building out this case through Yale, it's taken a monumental effort through a collective of really, really talented legal students. And I'll kick it over to Brother Brooks to give the lowdown on how you can reach out more formally. You can always email us at Black Veterans Project at info@blackveteransproject.org.
We are going to be going through a strategic planning process in the next 6 months, which will hopefully position us well to think about how we leverage volunteers. I think that's been a real gap in our work streams, and there's so many folks that want to give of themselves to this work, and we want to make sure that we can do that in a way that is smart and strategic, and ultimately leverages all of their values. So thank you for your patience. Sometimes I get some angry emails from folks who are just frustrated because they do want to help, they do want to be supportive, and they don't necessarily see a clear path to doing that. Following the case is certainly one way. Continuing to support the organization, letting folks know about the organization, helping us fundraise is also an obviously very clear way. But hopefully in the next few months here, we'll have a little bit more clarity about how you might be able to more formally plug in. So thank you.
Yes, I do have a question. Is there any way that I can be part of the lawsuit? There's probably
yes.
Depending?
Mother Brooks, yes. I'll let you.
Yes. I can answer that question for you. First of all, thank you for your service, and I'm sorry we haven't been able to connect with you. I'm going to give you an email address right now, and I'll send it over to Brother Elliot and Brother Richard after the end of the show so that they can put it up. But if you experienced racial discrimination by the VA and you want to file a claim, send us an email at ftca.veterans@ylsclinics.org. ftca.veterans@ylsclinics.org. And I'll just say, I'm sorry, I should have been clearer about this earlier, is that part of what we're trying to do in this case is put together a class action. We are trying to contact as many folks who have had this experience as possible and see how many we can get together and make it a big group. So we would love to hear from you, and please email us and let us know your story.
Mm. Okay, well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to reaching out to you guys.
Thanks for your contribution, sir.
Thank you.
Elliot, before you go to the next caller, can I ask the gentleman a question? I don't know if it's burning or just it may be vague.
No, certainly.
You know, Mr. Monk, you know, using the frame of reference, you know, of all of you, the frame of reference from 1944 now, my thinking is that the bureaucracy, when we talk about black veterans, there's two levels that I'm looking at, the Department of Veteran Affairs as a national, and then the local branches, and the people who service these local branches of the veterans. And I'm wondering, how does that pan out when we know in 1945 there were more white and probably white males that were the evaluators and decision makers in relationship to these specific cases that comes to them? As we move to Vietnam, is still a large in the bureaucracy still. Today it may not be. It may be more mixed in relationship to black and white at the local branch level and the national. Is that a fair assessment to look at when we're talking about men and women who go to and filing their cases at they're filing their cases at local branches and then getting evaluated, if I'm not mistaken. Is there a difference in this time period in relationship to understanding even this court case than, say, in 1944? If the question makes sense.
It makes sense.
Can you repeat the question one more time? I apologize.
Is it a difference in who is actually reviewing black veterans' cases and denying them, or even, you know, from 1945 compared to
I mean, so our FOIA efforts have largely focused on the last 20 years, right? So obviously there's a bit of a catch-all for anyone who's filed claims within the last 20 years. There are a large cross-section of folks from the Vietnam era that are included in that. But, you know, we don't have, you know, data and metrics that go beyond that just yet. What we do know exists, though, is are these internal reports, right? And in aggregated, I mean, there's a government accountability office study that was also done that looked at the last 10 years of disability compensation, specifically around mental health. What we're finding is the largest gaps are really in around kind of, you know, mental health, disability for PTSD, so on and so forth. And yeah, I do believe that the VA does have the ability to heat map. I mean, it'd be ridiculous to think that the second biggest federal agency in our government doesn't keep good records. I think they do. And I think that it's partly our responsibility to make sure that all of what they do have comes to light, which speaks to Brother Brooks's kind of mission and the mission of Yale Law School as they move through this discovery process to try to find as much detail as they possibly can. But we know based off of conversations that we've been having with folks that, you know, that the VA does know to some degree who are the kind of main culprits of some of these denials, down to the physicians and down to the clinics and the regions that are most susceptible. They have this data. I think we've always known that they have this data, which is partly why we've been slowly but surely doing all these large FOIA efforts to try to get our hands on as much data as possible. But the discovery process really gives us an unprecedented opportunity to actually get to have this case heard on its merits in a court of law. One of the few reparations cases ever to move forward in this way. But certainly it also provides an opportunity to force the VA to the table in a way that has never happened in history.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let's go to Newport News.
Hey, great program, gentlemen. I just want to make a short comment of encouragement. I'm 70 years old. But to listen to you gentlemen reconstruct how you took the personal into the collective is something that I think people really need to pay attention to. Even though you have your unique personal stories, you understood the importance of the commonality. I really appreciate this. And I actually served on the combat crew in the Air Force, but I came right after the Vietnam era, but in a different program, I can talk about what it's like to sit underground with a black person and a northerner from Oklahoma and have them eager to turn the keys on the largest nuclear weapon in the world, then having to sit in front of psychologists and be asked what's wrong with you. So there's a lot of trauma when it comes to the military and black people. I also want to throw something else out. It's interesting that you talk about how hard it is to get the benefits, and things haven't improved much because I ran across in research 46% of enlisted black female soldiers in this country are black women. That says a lot about them going into something that's not set up to help them once their utility expires. Great work, gentlemen.
Thank you for your contribution, sir. Richard, you had, I think the question that you had asked, you wanted Mr. Monk to weigh in on it.
Yeah, yes. As far as just, because I'm thinking of in listening to the caller from Atlanta, you know, people go into these branches and there's people there who are evaluating or saying no based off of an evaluation. They're the ones that are meeting them. And I'm dealing with the quote unquote racism in the system. And I'm just wondering, is that, you know, over time now we have different people there. There's more black employees who are sitting at this desk that's making these evaluations. And I'm just wondering, you know, I guess based off of what Mr. Brookshire said, that whether the data will show a difference or show a continuity. Still a resistance, especially in these particular type of cases. So I was wondering, do you think, Mr. Monk, that the local people going to their local branch area and the people are sitting in front of them already have a bias?
I get what you're saying. And see, I'm just going to give a general paintbrush. Mm-hmm. From what I see, they have a system set up, whereas they feed you into the computer a lot now, too. But so it's still color-coded as far as I'm concerned. If you do the due diligence and find out right now how many benefits are given to people, melanated people opposed to Caucasians, that it's still disproportionately favoring the Caucasian. And we're not getting the upgrade of our benefits or receiving the benefits that we should get. Or we go through the system more times than they go through the system, meaning you're denied and you're denied and then finally you get it. But daggone it, sometimes you could be hung up in an appeals court for 2 years. And these young men and young ladies don't have that lifespan to do this. I'd say, honestly, that people be dying waiting for their benefits. They actually do. And my brother Conley had put in a lawsuit. And I forget the name of that one, but because the VA take too long to process the claims. So we actually won the right as a class action. Veterans can sue as a class action lawsuit as a result of that lawsuit. Never could sue the government, but you now can sue them because it takes too long to do their claims. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I don't have the information right now, the current information, but yeah. So many people come through our office that's been denied and been denied and been denied.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, and I think that I'll just reiterate, too, that, you know, part of the discovery process, hopefully we'll be able to get data that goes, you know, in the far reaches of the ether, back to the 70s and 60s and 50s and so on. But I think what the most important thing is, even in the most recent 2 decades of the longest war in American history, when the VA had data and metrics and the ability to study this issue, they had, you know, internally studied it on multiple occasions, buried the reports so that they would never see the light of day. And because of that, maintained a disparity. So, yes, there's bias in the system. It's implicit. It's maintained itself because the VA has been negligent in its responsibility to address it. And because of that, tens of billions of dollars have come out of the hands of Black, otherwise deserving and folks, not even just deserving, it's theirs, right? Benefits that they should have been getting, largely Black, but also Latino veterans. And so I think that in the months ahead and the year ahead, as we continue to dig, I hope that we'll be able to come back on with much more specificity to speak to in more detail. But everything that we've been able to gather to date over the course of the 5 years that Black Veterans Project has been around, speaks to the fact that there is bias, speaks to the fact that there has been certainly a grave cover-up, and speaks to the fact that tens of billions of dollars have been siphoned out of the Black community, and there's a case for reparations to be made.
And because this is a case for reparations, and I apologize, Ellie, but it's interesting because, you know, locally here, well, you may not know, locally here we have had a reparations commission put in place to study us in relation to harm by the city of Philadelphia. I'm wondering, by calling this reparations and being a reparations case, you know, taking outside the understanding that the process is still going on as far as discovery, what do you think how this will be helpful to other
reparations? Yeah, I mean, so I hear that pushback often, right? Like people are, you know, scared of the R word. But I think that it's the responsibility specifically of Black patriots, of Black veterans, to shift that public narrative, right? To really push and make the case for repair, ultimately. Whether you want to use the word reparations, you want to use the word reparative justice, you want to use the word repair, you want to use the word, I don't like using the word racial equity, because baked into racial equity is future oriented, and we're talking about past grievances being resolved or repaired in some way, and those are not the same conversation. And so I think that ultimately we have a responsibility to mainstream the concept of reparations in this country, and to force the hands of the American public through really strong narrative building efforts, through really strong organizing, through making the case that this is something that's just, and to kind of overcome the narrative barrier that we've had for decades, that I think is completely possible, completely and utterly possible. But I hear it all the time. Some folks don't like that language for their own personal reasons. I'd love to hear any of yours. That's my thought is we shouldn't shy away from what this actually is, because it undermines the broader movement that it has, that exists outside of just the conversation relating to Black veterans and benefits.
Mm. Yes.
Let's go to Detroit.
Uh-oh. Dr. Henderson. See you there.
Can you hear me? Detroit. Uh-oh. Well, let's see. I don't know. It's audio. Let's go to New York City. New York.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Brother Marie.
No worries,
sir. I was listening to a lot of stuff that y'all were saying, and I'm glad that, you know, I did a show on the article they did about the lawsuit that you brought, probably about when it first came out back in 2022. But I think that the one thing that I don't want people to miss out on, one of the biggest things that happened in the U.S. was dealing with the mistreatment of the soldiers. It was actually part of the biggest civil rights movement event that ever happened. When Isaac Woodard, when his eyes got gouged out, and that led to the uproar of black people and them changing the law in the military. So the treatment of black veterans has been a part of the civil rights movement, as part of the reparations movement from day one, from the mistreatment of them. The other thing that I want to say also, I texted Brother Elliot, I said that, you know, I had three friends that went into the military, and they all cracked up in the military during peacetime. And they had to fight for years to get benefits. I knew older gentlemen, they tried to get their benefits, and then they talked about the fire where the records got destroyed, and they couldn't find their information and stuff. I haven't heard anybody talk about that, because millions of workers were lost in 73 at this particular fire, and I haven't heard anybody even mention that, or they have used that even as an excuse. So I don't want
they
people
have
to
use that. They have used that as an excuse relative to the passage of the housing loan legislation. But we were able to push back on that because you wouldn't necessarily need any of those particular files to legitimize the claims. I don't think that, you know, I think that as the case builds forward with Monk and Brother Brooks can speak more to this, we'll have to contend with many more of the challenges, like the fire and like how do you substantiate records and all of that. We just haven't gotten to that point. Litigation is a slow and lengthy process, and we're talking about, like I said, you know, the second biggest federal agency in our government in a really, really, really complicated case. But yeah, I mean, I hear all the things that you're saying, and I think that they're very thoughtful.
Well, again, I think that excuse me. I think there was a movement I try to acknowledge veterans every Veterans Day, especially Black and Latino veterans, and there was a movement that said it's okay to say I'm not okay. And I think that is important. And I remember I had a chance to interview some brothers that served in Vietnam. And the things that they talked about, I don't know how they wasn't getting any special treatment and stuff. And like I even said to Elliot, I said, just some of the stuff that y'all were talking about reminds me of Dead Presidents, the movie. When you looked at if you ever saw the movie, what happened? The guy came out of the military, he couldn't get a job. He had PTSD and stuff. He had all of this stuff going on. Other people had Agent Orange and stuff. So, again, I'll say this and I'll get off. I just want to make sure that even if it's not wartime, people suffer trauma being in the military. I had a friend went in during military, during peacetime. He served over in Europe. He came back. They gave him a dishonorable discharge. He ended up on the street. Was sleeping on the train, you know, got kicked out of several homeless places. We helped to fight for years to finally get him into a shelter, a decent place for the military. And then they put him on all these medications and stuff. And I now lost touch with him. So I just want to be clear about that. It's not just the people in wartime. The people that are suffering when they in the service. And I'll say that and get off. Thank you for the work that your brothers are doing.
Thank you for your contribution, as always. Let's go again to Detroit.
Hey, Brother Elliot, can you hear me now?
I hear you now.
Okay, thank you so much for taking up this issue, and thanks to the brothers at the Black Veterans Project. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Army. My brother, my biological brother, served two tours in Vietnam as a Marine. He's in Vietnam, and in his squad, white folks, white troops, members of an organization called Sponge. When he first told me this, I didn't believe it, but you can Google it now. I said, Lenny, my brother's name is Lenny. I said, Lenny, what is Sponge? He said, that's the Society for the Prevention of Niggas Getting Everything. These were in his squad in Vietnam. When I'm in the Army 12 years later, I'm not a combat veteran. You have the displaying of in the barracks of not just Confederate flags but Nazi flags. What the brothers are doing, this is so important because many of those people, the racist and sponge and the ones showing the flag, they go back and they become people at the VA, you see, and civilians. But I want to commend so much what the brothers are doing. I hope they will check out resources like the Vietnam Veterans Chapter Number 9 that me and my brother helped to just physically construct there on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. And the resources that are there, it's one of the largest chapters of Black Vietnam veterans in the country, to help them in what they're doing. And as a professor myself, I'm familiar with at least one of your board members, Dr. Perry, that there are resources that other academic institutions can provide for you. Because I didn't even know that you could circumvent the Ferris Doctrine and what you all are doing with a class action suit. I think that's just brilliant in what you all are doing. And as the brothers of Elliot and Richard know, I trace back to the Black veterans who fought and defeated the Confederacy and moved the Union toward ending chattel slavery, which was not the Union's initial war aim. That was us. That was Black folks, 200,000 of us, over 180,000 U.S. And Union Army, and over 19,000 in the Union Navy. That was us. So the veterans, so the obligation this country has to the veterans is even for our basic conception of freedom. And it was long acknowledged that Black veterans didn't receive the awards that whites did, so much so that we have Civil War veterans receiving medals, even the Medal of Honor, during the Clinton administration, because they went back over the records. So that's just a prima facie case for the discrimination that Blacks have suffered throughout the military service and long after. So I just want to commend you, you brothers, for what you are doing, and also what the brother said in the last time. There's some real concerns with our combat veterans, but also our peacetime veterans, as we've experienced the two longest wars in the U.S. history, in Afghanistan and Iraq. And just one thing I'd like to say for some of the folks who may be interested, and they may be looking at reserve training and things like that. Wherever you go to reserve training, always find out what's your unit's capstone mission. Always find. My brother schooled me on stuff like this. What his capstone mission is. Because that's what the unit does if the balloon goes up in time of war. So you may be chilling with, you know, a whole bunch of folks at the hospital there, as opposed to being in the tank unit as reservists. But if the capstone mission is they go to the theater of operations, then that's where you're on your way to, because there's a lot of the folks who experience combat as Black troops who made sure that the next generation would be better informed. So that we could avoid some of the things that they experienced. If I can tell you just one anecdote, just even in basic training. In basic training, all the squad leaders, the platoon leaders, all the leadership positions were held in my basic training by Black or brown folks. All of us were Black. The leadership positions, all of them were Black. But it's about getting people training, getting people in line, getting people up to snuff, the level of professionals, all Black. It came time for graduation, all those positions were replaced by white troops. Okay? So when it came for the parade for graduation, all the leadership positions were white. Okay? So these things continue, and they don't stop when you get to the VA. So I just commend you all, and I hope that I can assist as well, and I can share some of my information with Brother Elliot and Richard to share with you all. But the Vietnam Veterans Number 9, Chapter Number 9 in Detroit, Woodward Avenue. And I think that may be some useful resources for you all there. Thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Hold on, Professor Anderson. Let me see whether Mr. Brookshire or Mr. Brooks or even Mr. Monk want to have something to say to you.
Yes, sir.
Oh, no, thanks for that. I would love to connect. I think you sound like a wealth of knowledge, and I'm not familiar with what you're speaking about out of Detroit, so I'd be very, very interested in learning more about that. I don't know if you can send, I don't know if you have LinkedIn. You can send me a LinkedIn request, or you can email me at richard@blackveteransproject.org, and, you know, we can find time to connect. I'd love to connect.
That's what
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for your call. I really do appreciate you sharing your story. And I'll just repeat the email address again, ftca.veterans@ylsclinics.org. We would love to learn more about the work y'all are doing it up in Detroit.
Thank you so much, brother. And if you would share that with Elliot, y'all way too fast for me.
I'll make sure I put
my email address out there. Is that okay?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So I'm Gary Monk. I'm the executive director of the National Veterans Council for Legal Redress. And my email reads Gary Monk. That's Gary with two R's. M-O-N-K. E-X-E-C. D-I-R. At nvclr.org. One more time, that's Gary, G-A-R-R-Y-M-O-N-K, E-X-E-C-D-I-R, at nvclr.org. Thank you.
All right.
One thing Elliot is good at is making sure that after these interactions that people network. So I see for everyone who's called in and everyone who's listening for Two Time for Awakening, that these gentlemen, you know, this connection will be followed up on. I can say that. Can I, Elliot?
Brother yes, Elliot. Sir. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
Can I throw this in? I hate to interrupt, but I got to put this in because Brother Errol just did it for the slow people like me. Y'all got to encourage these wise people to use your chat function. Because it helps slow people like me to actually get a record of this, and I commend you again because you always bring on excellent guests. But help the text challenge people. Help us. Encourage them to use that chat. And I swear to you, because I'm old school, I literally use your chats and make short clips to send to people that want to argue against what you're presenting now. And that's the only way I can do it. That's my mission, is when I find people that know what they're talking about, actually root what they're doing in the data, and as I said before, they understand their unique personal connection, but they always present it to the public in the collective. That's a rare, rare ability, and I appreciate these gentlemen.
Thanks again for your contribution. Let's go to Philadelphia.
Yeah, good evening, Brother Elliot. Good evening, Brother Richard. And good evening to your three distinguished guests, Mr. Monk, Mr. Brooks, and Mr. Brookside. How y'all brothers doing tonight?
Yeah, everything's good.
Very good.
Praise be to Allah. I just want to say first, you know, when Professor Henderson Carr, when he was talking about how they replaced the black leaders or commanders, if you will, and everything, it reminded me how white folks, the tactics never change. You know, it's like a little... A proverb or analogy. If you know anything about horse racing, for the history of horse racing in this country, all the jockeys have been historically black. But as soon as horse racing became profitable, they got rid of all the black jockeys, replaced them with white men. I mean, we see clearly that tactic of white folks don't change none. You know what I mean? But anyway, you know, I join in with Brother Otis and Professor Henderson, and I applaud y'all gentlemen for what y'all are doing. Y'all took a personal thing and y'all turned it to the collective, because that's what at the end of the day, to me, that's what it's about. You know, on the collective, they try to get redressed for our black veterans, living and dead, especially the ones that still living like y'all. They dress those things because my father, late father, he was in the service, he was in the Navy, and he did experience like y'all. He experienced discrimination back in the 40s and 50s and all that kind of stuff. So what y'all doing is admirable and noble what y'all doing. I applaud y'all for that, because we see clearly the beat goes on with discrimination against black veterans and stuff, you know, and you go all the way back to the Civil War, I guess you know, you go back to the Revolutionary War where the first black person died was Crispus Attucks, and bringing on up to speed now. So, I mean, so we clearly see black veterans have always suffered in this military and everything. And, you know, when y'all brothers were saying thank you for your service, see, I have no problem with y'all saying it because y'all experienced it and y'all did your duty. But when I heard some of these white men, I always cringe when I heard them say thank you for your service, especially when they said to black people, because I know a lot of the times when they say it, it's not sincere. Like, for example, today I was watching some of the football game on one of the stations, and they interviewed two black veterans at halftime, but again, they interviewed a brother, and they interviewed a sister, and they was talking about their service, and the white commentator who worked, I think, for Fox or whatever, he's told both of them, thank you for your service. And I'm saying to myself, that sounds good, but are you really thanking them for their service? You understand what I'm saying? Or are you just saying it because it's just something to be said, you know? So that's why I applaud y'all for doing what you're doing, because often you've heard that thing about black veterans in this country, they're always fighting the two system. I heard black veterans say on Eyes on the Prize, the series that PBS did years ago, where black veterans said they had to fight against Hitler and at the same time fight against Jim Crow right in the service. You know what I mean? So black veterans have always had their hands full. And, you know, like when Brother Maurice made a good point about the brother who had his eyes gouged out, and it reminded me of another egregious case that happened with Lewis Till. For people that might not know, that was Emmett Till's father, and that's why I say my heart goes out to somebody, Miss Mobley Till, because she suffered two tragedies and stuff. You know, it was worse bad enough that her son was murdered in Lynch by white racists and murderers, but her husband, who was serving his country over in World War II, he was falsely accused. I mean, many people say he was trumped up charges. He was falsely accused of raping and murdering his white woman over there. And I think it was in Italy, if I think remember correctly. And he was executed. And a lot of people believe he was falsely accused of that. So we see clearly that black veterans have always had to deal with this double thing of racism and at the same time trying to fight for the country or whatever. And, you know, so just a whole lot of things. So I just want to say in closing, Mr. Brooks and Mr. Brookside and Mr. Monk, I applaud y'all for doing what y'all are doing. And I pray to God that y'all be successful, because Lord knows our black veterans need to get all the benefits that they deserve for dealing with all this here stuff. And like you said, the PTSD, because I know some brothers that I went to high school with that came back from the service, and someone was doing in peacetime, they came back kind of messed up and everything and stuff. So what y'all are doing is noble, and I applaud y'all for doing what y'all are doing. And I pray to the Creator that y'all be successful. And Elliot, you know, good show, Elliot, very good show. And again, Brother Otis and Brother Maurice make some good, and Brother Hens, Dr. Henderson made some very good points. I'm learning a whole lot myself tonight. So thank you a lot.
Let me ask you a question before you go. You said that your dad was in the Navy.
Yes, he was.
Where was he in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam?
I think he was in Korea, if I remember correctly. Yes, he was in Korea, and he experienced like a lot of veterans, Brother Ellie. He experienced racism and everything like that. Like most veterans, he had to deal with the race, the bigots, and stuff like that. And you know, as a matter of fact, I will say this in closing about my dad. My grandmother, who was his mother, she said it was like a double-edged sword for him going to military, because she said it taught my dad discipline. Right, and stuff like that. No question about that. But at the same time, he picked up some bad habits. My grandma always said, because my dad was like a teetotaler. He never smoked or drank in his life. He wouldn't even go nowhere near cigarettes or alcohol. But after he came out of the military, he became a drinker and a smoker. And my grandma always could contribute that to the service. She said, because he never would touch none. He was an athlete. He never touched none of that stuff. So for her, it was like a double-edged sword, you know. So, you know. But thanks, Brother Ellie. And again, to your distinguished guest, Mr. Brooks, Mr. Brookside, Mr. Monk, y'all brothers keep doing what y'all doing, because you know you got a lot of support out there. Thank you, Brother Elliot. Put me on mute and I listen to the rest of the show.
Thanks for your contribution.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for being with us this evening to share this important information. The door is open for you to come back anytime any new developments happen. Anything that you want to share, if you can't make it on, just email me. I'll make sure the listening audience hears it. But I'd much rather somebody comes on and kind of talk about it. So, again, the door is always open. Any new developments, anything that comes on, we're here.
And, thank you for having us.
And before you go, just listen, give out the contacts again. The email addresses.
Yeah. I'll
if you want to put it in the chat room, you could do it. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I'll start. I mean, you can follow Black, if you're not familiar with Black Veterans Project, please visit our website, blackveteransproject.org. Or you can, I recommend our Instagram. It's probably where you can see most of our work in a really comprehensive way. Black Veterans Project on Instagram, Black Vet Project on Twitter. Yeah, and just if you can reach out to us at info@blackveteransproject.org if you have specific questions. But give us some time because we are a growing but mighty machine. And we just thank you for having us.
Great, great.
So, excuse me, Gary Monk, I would recommend that you go to our website, www.NVCLR. That's the National Veterans Council for Legal Redress. And you can get an overview of what we've been doing and so forth. You can contact us there as well. I was providing you with my personal email address so I can get back to you probably quicker. So all you just do is reference the program. And again, my name is Gary with two R's. And this is my email address, Monk, M-O-N-K, E-X-E-C-D-I-R. At nvclr.org. And so I just want to thank the host. You know, you're holding the space for transformation of something that hasn't been moving. It's what we've been saying all night. And so this is so big for what you're doing. I just want you guys to get how much this means to us, meaning my colleagues, Mr. Brookshire, Rich Brookshire, Mr. Brooks, that the work that we're doing would be in vain if it can't be disseminated at a mass level. And so you guys are doing so with a conscious audience. I mean, think about the name of your show, Time for Awakening Media. When I heard that, I was moved, touched, and inspired. So I'm just saying, right back at you, for the work that you guys are doing. And thank you for inviting us and having us on the show. And we will certainly be back. We get something new that we can share with you. Thank you so much.
Great, great. Richard.
Yes, yes.
And just, I just want a second, what Mr. Monk said. So grateful to have been invited, and hopefully we'll be back soon with some more good news. For listeners who want to get in touch with the Veteran Legal Services Clinic at Yale Law School, if you are a Black vet who experienced racial discrimination by the VA and are interested in filing an administrative claim with the VA, please send us an email at stca.veterans@ylsclinics.org. stca.veterans@ylsclinics.org. Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to talk to you tonight.
All right. Thanks for you men being with us. And we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back. Thanks again, guys. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Take care.
Listening to Time for an Awakening.
Time for an Awakening.
With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
BrotherElliott.com.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commits You Black family, to join your interconnected Commits You Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
In this crooked game of power politics here in America, the Negro, namely the race problem, integration, civil rights issue, are all nothing but tools used by the whites who call themselves liberals against another group of whites who call themselves conservatives, either to get into power or to retain power. Among whites here in America, the political teams are no longer divided into Democrats and Republicans. The whites who are now struggling for control of the American political throne are divided into liberal and conservative camps. The white liberals from both parties cross party lines to work together toward the same goal. And white conservatives from both parties do likewise. The white liberal differs from the white conservative only in one way. The liberal is more deceitful, more hypocritical than the conservative. Both want power, but the white liberal is the one who has perfected the art of posing as the Negro's friend and benefactor. And by winning the friendship and support of the Negro, the white liberal is able to use the Negro as a pawn or a weapon in this political football game that is constantly raging between the white liberals and the white conservatives. The American Negro is nothing but a political football.
There has always been a white man's party in the United States. For most of the history of the United States, that white man's party has been the Democratic Party. But then in the 60s, the parties switched places, but there was still a white man's party and another party that claimed that it was more inclusive. This duopoly system is a political arrangement that balances itself out and in which the two parts react to each other. This arrangement makes promises to its constituencies, and it makes those promises in order to keep them voting for the representatives of the rich people who control both of those parties. But this representation has benefited the black misleadership class, which owes its existence to the Democratic Party, or feels that it does. For that reason, this black misleadership class is the last part of the duopoly that will budge from this arrangement. But the black political class remains the most loyal element in that duopoly situation. Their allegiance is to the party that has nurtured their rise in social and economic status. Their allegiance is not to the larger black community, and that will not change. The duopoly system itself mitigates against independent black politics on the electoral level. It's not some fault among our people. It's the system that we have to operate in, or that has been imposed on us, that says you will have no independent politics, because that would violate the logic of the duopoly. It means that you are abandoning the fight against the white man's party because you are not collaborating fully and wholeheartedly and entirely with the Democratic Party.
Welcome back. Time for an awakening. Richard.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting conversation we had with our guests this evening, Mr. Richard Brookshire, Mr. Raylan Brooks, and Mr. Gary Monk, and their activism around that issue, man. I mean, you heard what they said about the importance of getting the word out and the importance of collective black media working together.
Right.
Richard, before we go, man, I want to share something with you, and because I know that you kind of keep up on a lot of this stuff. On Monday, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, the Congress came out with an amendment or an addendum, I guess, for lack of a better term, in reference to these protests on college campuses. It was kind of odd, and not odd, but, you know, in relation to what Glenn Ford is talking about in that clip that I just played, because the Speaker of the House, the Republican Speaker, went to Columbia University, I think it was late last week, Wednesday or something of last week, and spoke with the university leadership, and then had meetings with Congress when they came out with this legislation. Now, that took less than a week, Richard. And they came out with basically bipartisan legislation against what's going on to silence a lot of this stuff on college campuses with bipartisan support. In fact, the Republican leader of Congress is a Trump supporter. He's MAGA. But it was 15 co-sponsors, and a lot of them was Democrats. Now, I haven't got the chance to look at the co-sponsors, but I can figure that one of them was probably Hakeem Jeffries.
Right.
So, you know, see, our people got to look at these people. I'm telling you, the more and more, a lot of our people are not asleep anymore. They're realizing what's going on. They're realizing that they're being played by a lot of these black elected officials that use them to get votes, but then do the opposite or speak in other people's behalf once they get in. But,
yeah.
I wanted to share this because this happened today. It was in the Washington Post today. I think it happened late last night or when it just happened. Israel shuts down Al Jazeera's operations and raids Jerusalem offices. Israel's government moved on Sunday to shut down all Al Jazeera media networks operations in Israel, clamping down on one of the few international broadcasters providing largely uninterrupted coverage of the Gaza war. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the decision followed a unanimous vote by Israel's war cabinet that the incitement channel of Al Jazeera will be closed in Israel. In a separate statement, he accused Al Jazeera's correspondents of having harmed the security of Israel and said that the time has come to eject Hamas's mouthpiece out of the country. This is a dark day for media, says the board, the Foreign Press Association, in a statement. This is a dark day for democracy. They've confiscated the equipment to close the office as per the order. Stephanie Dicker, a senior foreign correspondent for Al Jazeera English, said she felt she left the office, referring to the government edict shutting down the channel also. In a statement Sunday, the network criticized what is called a deceptive and slanderous move, according to the World Free Press Day. Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Jerusalem, Walid Amari, told the network Sunday that there has been more than 50 attacks against Al Jazeera journalists since October the 7th, when Hamas militants killed some 1,200 people inside Israel. Relatives of Al Jazeera's journalist Amza al-Duwal, and I know I'm butchering that name, including his widow and his father. In December, Al Jazeera's cameraman, Zamir Adu Daga, 45, was killed by an Israeli drone attack when he reported in Khan Yunis. A veteran Gaza correspondent was also injured in the attack. Dahu Hamza, also a journalist, was killed in a drone operation by Israeli drone strike in January. The network vowed Sunday to pursue all available legal channels through international legal institutions in a quest to protect both its rights as journalists as well as the right for public, the right to information. So we see here, Richard, that a shutdown of the media has occurred over there in Israel as far as getting news out to exactly what's going on there. And usually when a media shutdown happens, then more of this crackdown is going to occur. You know, that invasion of Rafah is probably imminent because of this media obliteration, kicking the media out.
You know, I may be using the term too loosely, but out of this, you know, with, you know, the media shutdown in Israel and the, you know, the silencing or the attempt to silence speech on the college campuses of those who are not in support of Israel, moves to this, you know, this thing, you know, this fascism. You know, because it starts with, I mean, there is no physical harm being done. And in what you just read, it seems like a lot of the Al Jazeera journalists were harmed compared to what he, you know, Netanyahu is making a case of, supposedly making a case that strategic, you know, it has some strategic military disadvantage for them, having this communication outlet there. So here we are with two different worlds, and both of them are shutting down the access of information because they don't like it. And that's what, I don't know, again, it may not be technical, but this is where this notion of fascism percolates in my mind.
Yeah, and it you know, you always associate that, especially when you talk to some of our people, they associate it with this Donald Trump. But it's associated with this government, period. I don't care whether it's Trump or Biden. It's the same thing. But more and more of our people are starting to see and expose these mouthpieces that are speaking out in reference to this militarism and speaking out for a foreign government. Happen to look like me and you, but they're being exposed. Our people ain't sleep.
Yeah.
They had, and I'm going to play these two clips because and I did want to play, but it was a little lengthy, so I might forego that. I know you saw when Cornel West was on the I forgot the guy's talk show, and he called him a racist and a liar. They kind of got into it. But they had a young black guy that he infiltrated, I think, UCLA. And, I mean, you know, I don't know where they dig these people up. They always, if they have somebody black on there with one point of view, they always put another black guy up there that with some old crazy perspective. But I probably won't play that clip today because it's a little lengthy. But I want to play two clips. One, the press secretary for Biden, Corinne Jean-Pierre, and what she said in reference to the media being shut down. Because a foreign correspondent asked her, and I could tell that the woman was foreign, you know, by her accent, but she asked her a question. And see, this goes to, Richard, about the world not only seeing this happening, but seeing the mouthpieces that the United States is using, whether it's Jeffries, Meeks, Greenfield, or others, Lloyd Austin. They're seeing these people. Yeah, I mean, you follow what I'm saying.
Yes, yes.
Let me play this clip. One of it is by the Jordanian queen. Now, Jordan happens to sign a peace treaty with Israel. I think they've been involved in a peace treaty with Israel for 25 years. But listen to what she said in reference to the situation going on there. Then I'm going to play Corinne Jean-Pierre and what she said.
House. Jordan is a key ally of the U.S. and for the past 30 years has had a peace treaty with Israel. We spoke with his partner, Queen Rania Al Abdullah of Jordan, on Thursday. She's of Palestinian descent and an advocate for children. We began our conversation on the impact of the war between Israel and Hamas and America's role in the region.
People view the U.S. as being party to this war because, you know, Israeli officials say that without a U.S. support, they couldn't launch this war. You know, you turn off the tap and the weapons dry out. So there's been anger in our part of the world, not at just what's happening, mm-hmm. but at the world's reaction. When we see these violations, human rights violations and international law violations, and we're watching the world letting it happen, when October 7th happened, the world rightfully condemned it and took strong action and strong positions. We are outraged that the same is not happening when Palestinians are getting killed. And so there is a sense of the selective application of humanitarian law and a sense of unfairness, a sense of our lives don't matter as much.
You said people back home see the United States as complicit in what's happening?
They see it as an enabler, you know. So clearly the U.S. is the country that has most leverage over the U.S., mm-hmm. over Israel. And like I said, you know, it is the biggest ally and biggest supporter. And the Arab world is getting, the rest of the world actually, is getting mixed messages. So on the one hand, the U.S. is demanding that more aid rightfully go back into Gaza. At the same time, they're denying that the starvation is intentional. On the one hand, they are outraged by the attacks on the aid convoys, but at the same time, they're denying that Israel is violating international humanitarian law. There's an expression of concern over civilian deaths, but at the same time, there's a provision of offensive weapons to Israel that are used against Palestinians. When you try so hard to thread the needle, you can risk dropping the ball. You can risk letting your values and principles unravel. And that has a deep impact. Either everyone is accountable or no one is. So the next time a country breaks the rules, you know, and the U.S. comes and tries to apply more authority, those countries are going to say, well, you made an exception here. So why apply it to us? I think Gaza now is like a microcosm of our new world disorder, of the breakdown of international norms, of the return of might is right. And I think that's very dangerous, not just for our region, but for the entire world.
Richard, you heard her say that her part of the world is viewing this as the U.S. being complicit in what's going on, right?
I've been saying it for I don't know how long.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand that. I'm preaching to the choir when I'm saying it to you. But I'm just saying that
Right.
She's saying that the world is viewing this, and her part of the world is viewing this as America being complicit. But who is the voices that's saying it for America is what I'm talking about. Black people should not be sitting there and letting the world get a view that black folks here are complicit in this type of this carnage.
That's the point.
Because of what these few people want to do, because they're getting money stuffed in their pocket like Jeffries and others. Now, look at the question. After Al Jazeera and the foreign media has run out of there, look at the question that they asked Jean-Pierre at this press conference and check out her answers.
Thank you, Karine. International doctors has been describing horrific scene at the Shifa Hospital where 300 bodies were found. Some were tied up and executed, including doctors, women, and children. Is the White House calling for an independent investigation? And second, do you believe that Israel is in violation of international law? And just on another topic, the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, just passed a law banning international media from working in Israel. You always call Israel as an ally that you share value with. Is this a value that you share with?
So, a couple, you asked me two.
Now, Richard, did you hear the two questions that she asked?
Yeah.
She said that at this particular hospital, they found 300 people bound and gagged and executed. And a lot of them was women and children. Now, America media didn't put that out there. Mm. Foreign media put that out there and reported on it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and she asked about America going along with these atrocities. She asked her two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen to what she said as an answer.
That you shared value with. Is this a value that you share with? So, a couple, you asked me two very important questions, and I want to get to them. So, as it relates to, and I think you're speaking specifically, at least the reports that we've seen is about Al Jazeera specifically, but it doesn't matter, whichever, right, journalist more broadly. But to those particular report, we've seen the reports, and certainly I'm going to refer to Israel for what they may or may not be considering, but If it is true, a move like this is concerning. We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critical. It is critically important, and the United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do. And that includes those who are reporting in the conflict in Gaza. So we believe that work is important, the freedom of the press is important, and if those reports are true, it is concerning to us. And to your first question.
Now, Richard, she said if those reports are true.
They
know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it also
says there's a conflict, obviously, in the State and War Department. You know, she has to say that. She has to say freedom of the press, right?
Mm-hmm.
She can't deny that. So somebody, but on the other hand, by the actions of the Congress and the State Department and the War Department, they're supporting this.
Yes.
So to me, internally, it's a magnification of this split. And who would be more in a line? I mean, I'll leave it there. I think it's important because now it's being exposed that they either got schizophrenia up there or in there, or they got a conflict of power interests as it relates to what's going on with Israel.
Now let me play her double talk answer to the second question, because she didn't really give an answer to the first one. It's just right. We don't support that. We don't. But it's done. That's what a woman asked her. The question says, are you supporting this because you support Israel? And notice they're asking her. See, this goes back to that Jordanian queen saying that the world gets the impression that the United States is a supporter.
Right.
Well, she's at a press conference. She's a black woman. So what is the world seeing when she gives this convoluted answer, double talk? They don't see old Biden up there answering. They see her.
So look, Hamas should not be our truth. It is concerning to us. And to your first question, so look, Hamas should not be operating out of hospitals. We've said that. We've said that over and over again. And putting civilians at risk. That's what we're seeing. And we are concerned by how Hamas appears. They appear to have been able to reconstitute in a hospital so quickly. So we've always also made clear that we continue to support Israel's right to defend itself. But as we've also said, we do not want firefights in a hospital where innocent people, helpless people, people seeking medical care are caught in a crossfire. We don't want to see that. We have urged Israel to take every step to avoid civilian casualties. And this just points to how challenging Israel's military operation is because Hamas has intentionally embedded themselves into civilian infrastructure, into these hospitals. And so we've been very clear as it relates to the footage, as it relates to the photos and reportings. We have not verified that footage. We're reaching out to the Israeli government to get more information. But obviously, if these reports are true, that is indeed deeply concerning.
Now, Richard, here we go again. It's deeply concerning about these mass graves at hospitals with hundreds of people rounded up and executed. But her excuse is, well, Hamas is using these hospitals. Now, foreign press haven't verified any of that about them using hospitals. That comes from Israel and the United States putting it out there that these people are using hospitals. But then she said, well, we've told them we don't want to have firefights in hospitals, but you're giving them weapons. And I'm quite sure these doctors and women that's in there and children, they're not firing weapons. They don't have any guns firing at it. No. People are in there trying to get medical attention. So you go in there executing people, and then you got to answer for it. She's standing up there answering for it.
You know what brings to mind, too, Elliot, I feel compelled to say to those Black Americans that are sitting in the front of the class who say that, well, we ain't got nothing to do with nothing over there, right? Or other kind of comments or thoughts in that direction. Here is the question, and I think, you know, what you're raising in relationship to not just the imagery, but the principle. And for me, it's always the question of Black people's body politics as it relates to the principle. We don't have to have anything done over there. But what we're seeing, do we agree? We agree. When we are electing elected officials, whether you call them leaders or not, do we agree that they should be, in principle, from the constituency that they represent, that they should be falling in alignment with something that the world doesn't agree with and we shouldn't agree with. So, and you're also saying, and we shouldn't be the face of. We shouldn't be the visible face and mouthpiece of something that we don't agree with and we don't know who they speaking for. Is she speaking for the administration? She's speaking for the Congress. Our Congress obviously sending $95 billion and they always got to investigate are in agreement with and creating laws locally, domestically to the colleges that they shouldn't say anything in opposition to and making it an offense for them that they shouldn't agree with, but they are. I mean, isn't that the point you're making?
Yeah.
And it's a principle position. It's not necessarily whether we how we feel about or think about, even if you don't have a humanitarian emotional concern, from a point of principle, there should be free speech in relationship to a mechanism there that can communicate all sides or both sides, that there should be protection from ordinary citizens in conflict areas. If we give that up as a principle, what does that mean when something happens here? And you heard what did you say, the queen, what she said, look, what happens when other countries do the same thing? What can you say? And we're going to support that too?
Wow. Let's take this call in and see what's up. Let's go to Holly Springs. Are you there? No. Okay. Okay. Richard, before we go, let me give a caller.
Yeah, Brother Elliot, how you doing, Elliot?
Yeah.
Hey, Brother Richard, real quick, as you and Richard was talking, and I interviewed with the sister from Jordan, the Queen, and stuff, I saw an interview with Joy Reid on MSNBC this past week, and she was dynamite, man. She was saying how, you know, to a question about how part of the world, she says, and that he looked at the United States as complicit. You know what I mean? There's no two ways about it. But here's the thing. I'm switching the channel, and I'm watching. See, again, these people are so devilish, man. I'm watching that bigot, the Tally Bennett. You know, he's the former prime minister. He's the one that briefly took over Israel when he beat Netanyahu in that election. And so we see clearly that Palestinian people are in the siege, no matter whether it's Netanyahu or Bennett or either one of them bigots. They just evil people, man. And he was up there trying to say, he was saying the same stuff about the kids on the college campuses. They so ignorant. They supporting Hamas. You know, you can only hope that they'll grow up and everything like that. So the white boy said, well, do you think they have a point of view? No, because they support Islamic terrorists like Hamas, who's a threat to Israel. We're the only democracy in the Middle East, and they want to destroy Israel and everything. He said, well, what about the killings of innocent Palestinians? He just brushed over that. Well, you know, that's Hamas using people with shells. I mean, these people are just so evil. They can't. See, my point, Ellen and Richard, they don't even acknowledge Palestinian people's humanity, man. And when you don't acknowledge somebody's humanity, the battle is already lost right there. And they just refuse to, man. And that was the same old bigot, the Tally Bennett, that Sharpton had on a few months ago. And Sharpton was kissing his behind, trying to talk out of both sides of his mouth, saying, well, I condemn what Hamas did on October 7th, but, you know, innocent Palestinians being killed over there in Gaza. And, of course, he came back and said the same crazy stuff to Sharpton that he said tonight. Well, that's the war is hell. You know, innocent people get killed. There's, again, no acceptance of Palestinian humanity. And I know it's a pattern with Sharpton. He had another Jew on his show that had some rabbi on today. He never has nobody on to represent the Palestinian side. He always these. I get so sick of these Negroes, whether it's him, Jeffries, already. I always got these white Jews
But wait a minute. He don't have anybody on there that represents his people's point of view.
That's right.
Or the opposite. Right. But listen, he's a pastor, or he claims to be, mm-hmm. although mm-hmm. he don't have a church. You had over 1,200 pastors that signed a petition telling them to stop this war.
Mm-hmm.
Does he ever have them on?
Of course not. Of course not.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about.
These Negroes are, I'm going to cut you off, but these Negroes are, I get so sick of them with this. I don't, as a 62-year-old black man, I don't give a damn about these white Jews and their perspectives. I know their perspective is rooted in white supremacy and racism. The same hatred and mistreatment they're doing towards Palestine, they do it towards black people. They got no love for black people, man. I don't want to care what the former prime minister or the current prime minister or one of their lackeys have to say, because I know how they feel. They're a bunch of racist white bigots.
What is his objective? To keep having them on, whether it's Green, Black, Natalie Bennett. What is his objective?
And Ellie, I'm glad you said it, because he had Greenblatt on here back here, and Greenblatt was saying pretty much the same thing that Natalie Bennett was saying, you know, justifying killing Palestinians, man. And you call yourself the nation's number one civil rights leader. See, like I said, we have got to start calling these people out. These people are dangerous, man. And see, with the larger Time from the Wicked Orders need to understand these are black faces on white power. See, when these Negroes be up there, see, people that watch these stations, they honestly think that these Negroes speaking for black people. That's why they dangerous, man. And I'm saying to myself sharply, whatever credibility he think he has shown, he don't have none in my book because he never has nobody to represent either black people's point of view, like you said, the black ministers or the Palestinian point of view. He never have nobody. He always got some old Jew, white Jew, and I don't want to hear what these people got to say, man, because I already know where they coming from. They're racist bigots to the max, man. And see, here's another thing. I let you go on this note. You know, it's just amazing, Elliot, with Al Jazeera. Now you see this invasion of Rafah's element, and you see what's, man, so they're kicking Al Jazeera out because they want to be able to kill as many innocent Palestinians, where you won't have an objective voice like Al Jazeera just reporting the news. Because they know that at your prayer press over there, they're going to cover for Israel's atrocity, but they know Al Jazeera won't do it. So they're going to have that. So this invasion of Rafah is intimate. So when they kill innocent Palestinians, and like they said, at the hospital, with mass graves at the hospital, they're just going to run roughshod, and Al Jazeera won't be there to report it. That's the main reason why, look at the timing. You know, that you keep talking about invasion. And Rafa, so now I'm saying you kick Al Jazeera out, probably the most honest and most news outlet, probably the most integrity news outlet probably in the world. I mean, everybody says that. Brother Lynn Washington even said, he said, of all the news outlets in the world, more than the BBC, Al Jazeera is probably the best and fairest. They report on the way it is. They don't put their spin on it. They call it, they're like an empire in baseball. They call it right down the middle. They call it the way they see it. If Muslims doing something wrong, they call it out. If Jews doing something, they call it out. That's the way they roll and stuff, man, because they a fair news organization that's thug criminal, not yo, what's the matter there, because they get ready to do some serious atrocities over in Rafah, and the United States is complicit. And that dumbass that you played it for me, that John Pierre, she's a disgrace to black women. I can't believe the double talk that she just. Oh man, my head was exploding just now. Seriously, her that fool talk the way she talked. How the hell are you gonna sit there keep that nonsense about some? Well, Hamas, they're using people as human shields in the hospital. Stop with that nonsense, woman. Where's your integrity, woman? Where you a black woman? I know you might be a. I know you might get that sexual thing, whatever she calls herself, with the trans, whatever she is. But my point is, you're still a woman, or so-called woman. Where's your humanity and humanity as a woman that you can sit there and steep pouting that line about some damn Hamas using people as human shells? And even if that was the truth, that's what they said. See what they don't tell you. I'm going by international law, the Geneva Convention. Even if that was true, Elliot, you're still not allowed to do to go in there and kill people. If that was the case, it's still a violation of international law to go into a hospital and kill people, even if they was using the hospital people as shells, man. So either way, they're wrong. Israel is wrong. Either way it goes, they still got no win, man. And for her to keep being a damn mouthpiece for that old fart and keep pouting out them lies, she's I can't stand the sight of that woman. Every time I hear her voice, she makes me sick, man. She is a disgrace, along with Jeffries, Nixon, the rest of them Negroes, Sharpton. They make my, man, they, oh, let me get off this phone. They make me sick, man. So thanks, Elliot. And I'll listen to the rest of the show, man. Thanks, man.
All right. Let's go back to New York City.
Yeah, brother. This is Brother Maurice. I had to call back in because, I have to say this, you know, first of all, I don't think people realize the blessing that we have, that we could come every Sunday and hear the plain truth, you know. It's and you're seeing the value of that as avenues such as Al Jazeera and other avenues that were open to black individuals to be able to get the truth about the things that are going on around the world and in our local communities and our states. You see that the Griot just got rid of a bunch of.
I saw that.
Dr. Mark Lamont Hill was speaking up for the Palestinians. I'm seeing this on the narrative, and this is the thing that bothers me, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot, because I started to fall in with Brother Richard because I stopped just watching TV at all. After watching all of the stuff that I saw on TV, knowing the only place that you have now, really in the United States, is, I'm not promoting something, democracy now is like the only place that you can kind of go to get a balanced explanation of what's going on out here, because all of these channels are in lockstep with their lies. What Brother Joe is saying is 100% right. and it made me sick to my stomach. I couldn't even watch the news any longer after that. They're in lockstep with their lies about what they're doing because they're going to make sure that they have the rationale to do what the hell they're doing. And the thing that you said also is important because of the things that black people in America and across this world have suffered, we have an authentic voice to speak on behalf of people. And when you have black people that look like us that are co-signing on this foolishness or murder and all these other things of that nature, then it diminishes us, at all of us.
As a group, yes.
So again,
I agree.
I have to say I appreciate the work that you brothers are doing. I don't think people realize that. Because I'm going to say this part, I'm going to get off. Do you know what most black people watch to get their news and information from? MSNBC. I couldn't believe it when I saw the numbers. So when brothers just talk about that, listening to Al Sharpton and Joy Reid and all that, yeah, that's where they're going to. And what narrative are they telling you there?
Wow. Brother Maurice.
Because we can't go to regular radio and TV and stuff because the buffoonery is on. You got the Breakfast Club and all these other people inviting these people on that are speaking all this nonsense, trying to be fair and balanced. Why don't you be fair and balanced with the truth? And that's all I'm going to say, brother. I'm going to let y'all wrap up the show. But I just was so incited by just hearing this stuff and because I watched the news around the country in every city. And it's the same message. And it's, I remember being in the streets protesting things, understanding how young people felt, how they feel that this is their time and to speak the voice, to speak truth to power. And it is dangerous. I don't think people understand. Like you said, we got people talking about, oh, we can't voting rights. No, we couldn't get that passed. Right. Nobody could agree on that. We were talking about police reform. We couldn't get anything done like that. People protested the street. And both parties got together and did that. And Malcolm X, in the clip that you played, said it. It's a game. And I feel like with a bunch of hamsters going around in a wheel, damn it. And I'm sick of it. Now I'm getting off.
Thanks for your contribution, brother. Let's go back to Newport News.
Hey, Brother Elliot, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hey, look, I just want to put in, I hate to be a fanboy, but I can tell you, I love the work that y'all put in. I'm telling you, you're running a heck of a streak for 2024. You know, I followed you for quite a few years. But I want to say something like the brother that just finished talking. The interesting thing that really gets me when you start talking about trying to build with community, I'm listening to Clubhouse Spaces, some of them that Brother Richard, I don't know how the hell he does it, but he's a saint. He can suffer through 3 or 4 hours of these people with imagination. They really believe that their opinion, their personal take on life should govern everybody. That's why I tried to compliment the men that came on here, because I'll tell you, uniquely, if I wanted to tell you my story, I'll share it with you. I sit underground at a Titan II missile silo. So that's only 4 people sitting underground in a missile silo. But what people don't understand, at the time in 1973, that was the largest nuclear weapon in the world. So I go through 9 months of indoctrination, like these people tell you about, being in the military. I didn't suffer any physical stress. But again, I tell you, think about this. You're sitting in a 90-foot orb, a big round circle, with all this control, command and control stuff, 90 foot away is the largest nuclear weapon in the world. Now, I'm going to say this to you. I got out in 76 to go to school. But here's the interesting thing. When they were going to decommission that missile, they talked to us about, you're going to get assigned to Arizona, you're going to go to Arkansas, because it's only 3 states that had the missiles. Now, I'm going to try to make the point to you. The interesting thing was, I sat underground with a black man that came from Tuskegee, a white man, and they're the ones with the guns on their side. They got bars on their collars. But every time over a 3-year period, they sent us messages that we had to decode, and you're on alert. So that means this could be the time you turn the keys and this big warhead goes off 3,000 miles or wherever the hell is programmed, and the world's supposed to come to an end. But you know what really shocked me? is every one of those damn indoctrinated people. One white boy from Tennessee, two educated people, 8 years in education, one white, one black. They actually wanted to turn the key and the missile go. So after about a year underground with them, this is serious. The black man turned me in for having psychological problems because I would not admit that I wanted to turn the key. I said, you're a damn fool. You're literally going through the world thinking that because they trained you to use this thing, you should turn the keys and be happy. Like, what are you going to do tomorrow morning? Wake up and watch cartoons on Saturday morning? That's not how it works. And that's the reality when I tell you, when you see people that are talking, when you brought these people on today, I've been pushing this on some of these X spaces. You should have your story. I believe in narrative. But you should also understand that your story is unique, but the source of your problems is the same thing.
Okay.
White supremacy and understanding that the system is rigged to this point. When I hear people talk about, when this guy's talking about doing with the VA, I literally learned in the Air Force, there's no such thing as meritocracy. You know why? Because I was one of the black people that never failed a marijuana test, but watch white boys fail them and then get promoted ahead of us. So it didn't just stop at what they did with the VA. The system, because it works with people, it has to be attacked. And when you find people that are not willing to confront white supremacy, you get a bunch of people that make excuses and claim that it's we're not doing enough. No, I can watch your program and tell there's a whole lot of us doing that work, but we have to understand it may not hit the finish line in our lifetime. I can say that comfortably at 70. This is an ongoing process, and the thing I want to finish with is what I told people in some of these X spaces I've been listening to. If you think that getting a win means that you have solved the problem, you got to understand white folks, under the guise of understanding that they may not have majority rule, have already started rigging the system so they can maintain minority rule. Mm-hmm. We must increase for South Africa. But when you look at 26 to 30 damn states in this nation that have figured out how to erase the popular vote or the electric vote and have legislators decide who gets to pick the president, you got to understand, white folks are defending themselves in the long term. It ain't just about phenotyping what system you in or whether or not you believe in pan-Africanism. You understand in this system, white folks are protecting themselves well in advance.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you can have a system like Jackson, Mississippi, the capital of a state, and they don't want to solve the water problem, but they can come up with legislative action to do what? Cut themselves off from the system so they have white policemen and white court system, and the hell with it, leave the Negroes to themselves. We got to wake up in this country, brother. I love the work you do. Much love.
Thank you for your contribution. Listen, I'm going to give the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media, Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Africa Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting topics, dialogues, and discussion. And yes, I'm sorry, on African Perspectives, that's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on in the week, Mississippi on the Move, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi, Brother Patrick Lumumba, Brother Rodney Lowe, the alias Brother Dove Sack, Sister Crystal Denise, all the brothers and sisters, even the special guests that he have come on. That's Thursdays from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Friday, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 until Saturdays. From 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa with Dr. Janine James is host. And on Sundays, Time for an Awakening is back from 7 until. Also, Reparations Now, I think they'll be airing on Sundays or Mondays moving forward. But I'll let everybody know what's going on. But Reparations Now will be airing on Time for an Awakening Sundays, possibly Mondays, one of those 2 days. But we'll have it kind of nailed down by next program. I'll let you know. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. To save the children.